content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. And now, from the fiction section of the November 28, 1959 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Landlady by Roald Dahl. Billy Weaver had traveled down from London on the slow afternoon train, with a change at Reading on the way, and by the time he got to Bath, it was about 9 o'clock in the evening, and the moon was coming up out of a clear, starry sky over the houses opposite the station entrance. But the air was deadly cold, and the wind was like a flat blade of ice on his cheeks. "Excuse me," he said to a porter, "but is there a fairly cheap hotel not too far from here?"
"Try the Bell and Dragon," the porter answered, pointing down the road. "They might take you in. It's about a quarter of a mile along the other side." Billy thanked him and picked up his suitcase and set out to walk the quarter of a mile to the Bell and Dragon. He had never been to Bath before. He didn't know anyone who lived there. But Mr. Greenslade at the head office in London had told him it was a splendid town. "Find your own lodgings," he had said, "and then go along and report to the branch manager as soon as you've got yourself settled." Billy was 17 years old. He was wearing a new navy blue overcoat, a new brown trilby hat, and a new brown suit, and he was feeling fine. He walked briskly down the street. He was trying to do everything briskly these days. Briskness, he had decided, was the one common characteristic of all successful businessmen. The big shots up at the head office were absolutely fantastically brisk all the time. They were amazing. There were no shops on this wide street that he was walking along, only a line of tall houses on each side, all of them identical. They had porches and pillars and four or five steps going up to their front doors. And it was obvious that once upon a time they had been very swanky residences. But now, even in the darkness, he could see that the paint was peeling from the woodwork on their doors and windows, and that the handsome white facades were cracked and blotchy from neglect. Suddenly, not 6 yards away, in a downstairs window that was brilliantly illuminated by a street lamp, Billy caught sight of a printed notice propped up against the glass in one of the upper panes. It said, "Bread and Breakfast." There was a vase of yellow chrysanthemums, tall and beautiful, standing just underneath the notice. He stopped walking. He moved a bit closer. Green curtains, some sort of velvety material, were hanging down on either side of the window. The chrysanthemums looked wonderful beside them. He went right up and peered through the glass into the room, and the first thing he saw was a bright fire burning on the hearth. On the carpet in front of the fire, a pretty little dachshund was curled up asleep, with its nose tucked into its belly. The room itself, as far as he could see in the half-darkness, was filled with pleasant furniture. There was a baby grand piano and a big sofa and several plump armchairs. And in one corner he spotted a large parrot in a cage. Animals were usually a good sign in a place like this, Billy told himself, and all in all, it looked as though it would be a pretty decent house to stay in. Certainly it would be more comfortable than the Bell and Dragon. On the other hand, a pub would be more congenial than a boarding house. There would be beer and darts in the evenings and lots of people to talk to, and it would probably be a good bit cheaper, too. He had stayed a couple of nights in a pub once before, and he had liked it. He had never stayed in a boarding house, and, to be perfectly honest, he was a tiny bit frightened of them. The name itself conjured up images of watery cabbage, rapacious landladies, and a powerful smell of kippers in the living room. After dithering about like this in the cold for 2 or 3 minutes, Billy decided that he would walk on and take a look at the Bell and Dragon before making up his mind. He turned to go. And now a queer thing happened to him. He was in the act of stepping back and turning away from the window when all at once his eye was caught again and held in the most peculiar manner by the small notice that was there. bed and breakfast, it said. Bed and breakfast, bed and breakfast, bed and breakfast. Each word was like a large black eye staring at him through the glass, holding him, compelling him, forcing him to stay where he was and not walk away from that house. And the next thing he knew, he was actually moving across from the window to the front door, climbing the steps that led up to it and reaching for the bell. He pressed the bell. Far away in a back room, he heard it ringing, and then at once, it must have been at once because he hadn't even had time to take his finger from the bell button, the door swung open and a woman was standing there. Normally, you ring a bell and you have to wait at least a half minute before the door opens, but this person was like a jack-in-the-box. He pressed the bell and out she popped. It made him jump. She was about 45 or 50 years old, and the moment she saw him, she gave him a warm, welcoming smile. "Please come in," she said pleasantly. She stepped aside, holding the door wide open, and Billy found himself automatically starting forward. The compulsion, or more accurately, the desire to follow after her into that house, was extraordinarily strong, but he held himself back. "I saw the notice in the window," he said. "Yes, I know. I was wondering about a room." "It's all ready for you, my dear," she said. She had a round pink face and very gentle blue eyes. "Well, I was on my way to the Blue Bell and Dragon," Billy told her, "but the notice in your window just happened to catch my eye." "My dear boy," she said, "why don't you come in out of the cold?" "Well, how much do you charge?" 5 and 6 pence a night, including breakfast. It was fantastically cheap. It was less than half of what he had been willing to pay. "If that is too much," she added, "then perhaps I can reduce it just a tiny bit. Do you desire an egg for breakfast? Eggs are expensive at the moment. It would be 6 pence less without the egg." "5 and 6 pence is fine," he answered. "I should like very much to stay here." "I knew you would. Do come in." She seemed terribly nice. She looked exactly like the mother of one's best school friend welcoming one into the house to stay for the Christmas holidays. Billy took off his hat and stepped over the threshold. "Just hang it there," she said, "and let me help you with your coat." There were no other hats or coats in the hall. There were no umbrellas, no walking sticks, nothing. "We have it all to ourselves," she said, smiling at him over her shoulder as she led the way upstairs. "You see, it isn't very often I have the pleasure of taking a visitor into my little nest."
"Well, the old girl is slightly dotty," Billy told himself, "but at 5 and 6 pence a night, who gives a damn about that?"
"Well, I should have thought you'd be simply swamped with applicants," he said politely. "Oh, I am, my dear, I am, of course I am. But the trouble is that I'm inclined to be just a teeny-weeny bit choosy and particular, if you see what I mean." "Ah, yes. But I'm always ready. Everything is always ready day and night in this house. Just on the off chance that an acceptable young gentleman will come along. And it is such a pleasure, my dear, such a very great pleasure, when now and again I open the door and I see someone standing there who is just exactly right." She was halfway up the stairs, and she paused with one hand on the stair rail, turning her head and smiling down at him with pale lips. "Like you," she added, and her blue eyes traveled slowly all the way down the length of Billy's body to his feet, and then up again. On the second floor landing, she said to him, "This floor is mine." They climbed up another flight. "And this one is all yours," she said. "Here's your room. I do hope you'll like it." She took him into a small but charming front bedroom, switching on the light as she went in. "The morning sun comes right in the window, Mr. Perkins." "It is Mr. Perkins, isn't it?"
"No," he said, "it's Weaver."
"Mr. Weaver, how nice. I put a water bottle between the sheets to warm them up, Mr. Weaver.
It's such a comfort to have a hot water bottle and a strange bed with clean sheets. Don't you agree? And you may light the gas fire at any time if you feel chilly. Well, thank you, Billy said. Thank you ever so much. He noticed that the bedspread had been taken off the bed and that the bedclothes had been neatly turned back on one side, all ready for someone to get in. I'm so glad you appeared, she said, looking earnestly into his face. I was beginning to get worried. Well, that's all right, Billy answered brightly. You mustn't worry about me. He put his suitcase on the chair and started to open it. And what about supper, my dear? Did you manage to get anything to eat before you came here? I'm not a bit hungry, thank you, he said. I think I'll just go to bed as soon as possible, because tomorrow I've got to get up rather early and report to the office. Oh, very well, then. I'll leave you now so that you can unpack. But before you go to bed, would you be kind enough to pop into the sitting room on the ground floor and sign the book? Everyone has to do that because it's the law of the land, and we don't want to go breaking any laws at this stage in the proceedings, do we? She gave him a little wave of the hand and went quickly out of the room and closed the door. Now, the fact that his landlady appeared to be slightly off her rocker didn't worry Billy in the least. After all, she not only was harmless, there was no question about that, but she was also quite obviously a kind and generous soul. He guessed that she had probably lost a son in the war or something like that and had never got over it. So a few minutes later, after unpacking his suitcase and washing his hands, he trotted downstairs to the ground floor and entered the living room. His landlady wasn't there, but the fire was glowing on the hearth and the little dachshund was still sleeping soundly in front of it. The room was wonderfully warm and cozy. I'm a lucky fellow, he thought, rubbing his hands. This is a bit of all right. He found the guest book lying open on the piano, so he took out his pen and wrote down his name and address. There were only two other entries above his on the page, and as one always does with guest books, he started to read them. One was a Christopher Mulholland from Cardiff. The other was Gregory W. Temple from Bristol. That's funny, he thought suddenly. Christopher Mulholland. It rings a bell. Now, where on earth had he heard that rather unusual name before? Was it a boy at school? No. Was it one of his sister's numerous young men, perhaps, or a friend of his father's? No. It wasn't any of those. He glanced down again at the book. Christopher Mulholland, 231 Cathedral Road, Cardiff. Gregory W. Temple, 27 Sycamore Drive, Bristol. As a matter of fact, now he came to think of it, he wasn't at all sure that the second name didn't have almost as much of a familiar ring about it as the first. Gregory Temple? He said aloud, searching his memory. Christopher Mulholland? Such charming boys, a voice behind him answered, and he turned and saw his landlady sailing into the room with a large silver tea tray in her hands. She was holding it well out in front of her and rather high up, as though the tray were a pair of reins on a frisky horse. They sound somehow familiar, he said. They do? How interesting. I'm almost positive I've heard those names before somewhere. Isn't that odd? Maybe it was in the newspapers. They weren't famous in any way, were they? I mean, famous cricketers or footballers or something like that. Famous, she said, setting the tea tray down on the low table in front of the sofa. Oh, no, I don't think they were famous, but they were incredibly handsome, both of them. I can promise you that. They were tall and young and handsome, my dear, just exactly like you. Once more, Billy glanced down at the book. Look here, he said, noticing the dates. This last entry is over 2 years old. It is? Yes, indeed, and Christopher Mulholland's is nearly a year before that, more than 3 years ago. Dear me, she said, shaking her head and heaving a dainty little sigh.
I would never have thought it. How time does fly away from us all, doesn't it, Mr. Wilkins?
It's Weaver, Billy said. W-E-A-V-E-R.
Oh, of course it is, she cried, sitting down on the sofa. How silly of me. I do apologize. In one ear and out the other. That's me, Mr. Weaver.
You know something, Billy said? Something that's really quite extraordinary about all this?
No, dear, I don't.
Well, you see, both of these names, Mulholland and Temple, I not only seem to remember each one of them separately, so to speak, but somehow or other, in some peculiar way, they both appear to be sort of connected together as well, as though they were both famous for the same sort of thing. If you see what I mean, like Dempsey and Tunney, for example, or Churchill and Roosevelt.
How amusing, she said. But come over here now, dear, and sit down beside me on the sofa, and I'll give you a nice cup of tea and a ginger biscuit before you go to bed.
Oh, you really shouldn't bother, Billy said. I didn't mean you to do anything like that. He stood by the piano, watching her as she fussed about with the cups and saucers. He noticed that she had small, white, quickly moving hands and red fingernails.
I'm almost positive it was in the newspapers I saw them, Billy said.
I'll think of it in a second. I'm sure I will. There is nothing more tantalizing than a thing like this that lingers just outside the borders of one's memory. He hated to give it up.
Now, wait a minute, he said. Just a minute. Mulholland, Christopher Mulholland, wasn't that the name of the Eton schoolboy who was on a walking tour through the West Country, and then all of a sudden...
Milk, she said, and sugar?
Yes, please.
And then all of a sudden... Eton schoolboy, she said. Oh, no, my dear, that can't possibly be right, because my Mr. Mulholland was certainly not an Eton schoolboy when he came to me. He was a Cambridge undergraduate. Come over here now and sit next to me and warm yourself in front of this lovely fire. Come on, your tea's all ready for you.
She patted the empty place beside her on the sofa and sat there smiling at Billy and waiting for him to come over.
He crossed the room slowly and sat down on the edge of the sofa. She placed his teacup on the table in front of him.
There we are, she said. How nice and cozy this is, isn't it?
Billy started sipping his tea. She did the same. For half a minute or so, neither of them spoke. But Billy knew that she was looking at him. Her body was half turned toward him, and he could feel her eyes resting on his face, watching him over the rim of her teacup. Now and again he caught a whiff of a peculiar smell that seemed to emanate directly from her person. It was not in the least unpleasant, and it reminded him. Well, he wasn't quite sure what it reminded him of. Pickled walnuts? New leather? Or was it the corridors of a hospital?
At length, she said, Mr. Mulholland was a great one for his tea. Never in my life have I seen anyone drink as much tea as dear, sweet Mr. Mulholland.
Well, I suppose he left fairly recently, Billy said. He was still puzzling his head about the two names. He was positive now that he had seen them in the newspapers, in the headlines.
Left? She said, arching her brows. But, my dear boy, he never left. He's still here. Mr. Temple is also here. They're on the fourth floor, both of them together.
Billy set his cup down slowly on the table and stared at his landlady. She smiled back at him, and then she put out one of her white hands and patted him comfortingly on the knee.
How old are you, my dear? She asked.
17.
17, she cried. Oh, it's the perfect age. Mr. Mulholland was also 17, but I think he was a trifle shorter than you are. In fact, I'm sure he was, and his teeth weren't quite so white. You have the most beautiful teeth, Mr. Weaver. Did you know that?
They're not as good as they look, Billy said. They've got simply masses of fillings in them at the back.
Mr. Temple, of course, was a little older, she said, ignoring his remark. He was actually 28, and yet I never would have guessed it if he hadn't told me. Never in my whole life. There wasn't a blemish on his body.
A what? Billy said. His skin was just like a baby's. There was a pause. Billy picked up his teacup and took another sip of his tea, and then he set it down gently in its saucer. He waited for her to say something else. But she seemed to have lapsed into another of her silences. He sat there staring straight ahead of him into the far corner of the room, biting his lower lip. "That parrot," he said at last. "You know something? It had me completely fooled when I first saw it through the window. I could have sworn it was alive. Alas, no longer." "It's most terribly clever the way it's been done," he said. "It doesn't look in the least bit dead. Who did it?"
"I did."
"You did? Of course," she said. "And have you met my little Basil as well?" She nodded toward the dachshund curled up so comfortably in front of the fire, and Billy looked at it. And as he did so, he suddenly realized that this animal all the time had been just as silent and motionless as the parrot. He put out a hand and touched it gently on the top of its back. The back was hard and cold, and when he pushed the hair to one side with his fingers, he could see the skin underneath, grayish, black, and dry, and perfectly preserved. "Good gracious me," he said. "How absolutely fascinating." He turned away from the dog and stared with deep admiration at the little woman beside him on the sofa. "It must be awfully difficult to do a thing like that." "Oh, not in the least," she said. "I stuff all my little pets myself when they pass away. Will you have another cup of tea?" "No, thank you," Billy said. The tea tasted faintly of bitter almonds, and he didn't care much for it.
"You did sign the book, didn't you?"
"Oh, yes."
"That's good, because later on, if I happen to forget what you were called, then I could always come down here and look it up. I still do that almost every day with Mr. Mulholland and Mr.
Temple," Billy said, "Gregory Temple. Excuse my asking, but haven't there been any other guests here except them in the last 2 or 3 years? Holding her teacup high in one hand, inclining her head slightly to the left, she looked up at him out of the corners of her eyes and gave him another gentle little smile.
"No, my dear," she said, "only you."
And now, an essay from the American Chronicle section of the April 3rd, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine. The data delusion. We've uploaded everything anyone has ever known onto a worldwide network of machines. What if it doesn't have all the answers? By Jill Lepore. One unlikely day during the empty belly years of the Great Depression, an advertisement appeared in the smeared, smashed ant font of the New York Times classifieds. Wanted, 500 college graduates, male, to perform secretarial work of a pleasing nature, salary adequate to their position, 5-year contract. Thousands of desperate, out-of-work bachelors of arts applied. 500 were hired. Quote, "They were mainly plotters, good men, but not brilliant," end quote. They went to work for a mysterious Elon Musk-like millionaire who was devising, quote, "a new plan of universal knowledge," end quote. In a remote manor in Pennsylvania, each man read 300 books a year, after which the books were burned to heat the manor. At the end of 5 years, the men, having collectively read 750,000 books, were each to receive $50,000. But when, one by one, they went to an office in New York City to pick up their paychecks, they would encounter a surgeon ready to remove their brains, stick them in glass jars, and ship them to that spooky manor in Pennsylvania. There, in what had once been the library, the millionaire mad scientist had worked out a plan to wire the jars together and connect the jumble of wires to an electrical apparatus, a radio, and a typewriter. This contraption was called the Cerebral Library. "Now, suppose I want to know all there is to know about toadstools," he said, demonstrating his invention. I spell out the word on this little typewriter in the middle of the table. And then, abracadabra, the radio croaks out a 1,000-word synopsis of the knowledge of the world on toadstools. Happily, if I want to learn about mushrooms, I don't have to decapitate 500 recent college graduates, although, to be fair, neither did that mad millionaire, whose experiment exists only in the pages of the May 1931 issue of the science fiction magazine Amazing Stories. Instead, all I've got to do is command OpenAI's ChatGPT, quote, write a 1,000-word synopsis of the knowledge of the world on, quote, toadstools, end quote. Abracadabra. Toadstools, also known as mushrooms, are a diverse group of fungi that are found in many different environments around the world. The machine begins, spitting out a brisk little essay in a tidy, pixelated computer screen font, although I like to imagine that synopsis being rasped out of a big wooden box 1930s radio in the sticky baritone of a young Orson the Shadow Knows Wells. While some species are edible and have been used by humans for various purposes, it is important to be cautious and properly identify any toadstools before consuming them due to the risk of poisoning. He'd finish up. Then you'd hear a woman shrieking, the sound of someone choking and falling to the ground, and an orchestral stab. Da-da-da-da! If, nearly a century ago, the cost of pouring the sum total of human knowledge into glass jars was cutting off, in their prime, hundreds of quite unfortunate, if exceptionally well-read young men, what's the price to humanity of uploading everything anyone has ever known onto a worldwide network of tens of millions or billions of machines and training them to learn from it to produce new knowledge? This cost is much harder to calculate, as are the staggering benefits. Even measuring the size of the stored data is chancy. No one really knows how big the internet is. But some people say it's more than a zettabyte, which in this case means anything to you, is a trillion gigabytes or one sextillion bytes. That is a lot of brains in jars. Forget the zettabyte-ing internet for a minute. Set aside the glowering glass jars. Instead, imagine that all the world's knowledge is stored and organized in a single vertical steel case filing cabinet. Maybe it's lima bean green. It's got four drawers. Each drawer has one of those little paper card labels, snug in a metal frame, just above the drawer pull. The drawers are labeled, from top to bottom, mysteries, facts, numbers, and data. Mysteries are things only God knows, like what happens when you're dead. That's why they're in the top drawer, closest to heaven. A long time ago, this drawer used to be crammed full of folders with names like why stars exist and when life begins. But a few centuries ago, during the scientific revolution, a lot of those folders were moved into the next drawer down, facts, which contains files about things humans can prove by way of observation, detection, and experiment. Numbers, second from the bottom, holds censuses, polls, tallies, national averages, the measurement of anything that can be counted ever since the rise of statistics around the end of the 18th century. Near the floor, the drawer marked data holds knowledge that humans can't know directly but must be extracted by a computer or even by an artificial intelligence. It used to be empty, but it started filling up about a century ago, and now it's so jammed full it's hard to open. From the outside, these four drawers look alike, but inside, they follow different logics. The point of collecting mysteries is salvation. You learn about them by way of revelation. They're associated with mystification and theocracy, and the discipline people use to study them is theology. The point of collecting facts is to find the truth. You learn about them by way of discernment. They're associated with secularization and liberalism, and the disciplines you use to study them are law, the humanities, and the natural sciences. The point of collecting numbers in the form of statistics, etymologically numbers gathered by the state, is the power of public governance. You learn about them by measurement. Historically, they're associated with the rise of the administrative state, and the disciplines you use to study them are the social sciences. The point of feeding data into computers is prediction, which is accomplished by a way of a pattern detection. The age of data is associated with late capitalism, authoritarianism, techno-utopianism, and a discipline known as data science, which has lately been the top of the top hat, the spit shine on the buckled shoe, the roar of the whizziest Tesla. All these ways of knowing are good ways of knowing. If you want to understand something, say mass shootings in the United States, your best bet is to rifle through all four of these drawers. Praying for the dead is one way of wrestling with something mysterious in the human condition, the capacity for slaughter. Lawyers and historians and doctors collect the facts. Public organizations like the FBI and the CDC run the numbers. Data-driven tech analysts propose smart guns that won't shoot if pointed at a child, and gun detection algorithms able to identify firearms bearing people on their way to school. There's something useful in every drawer. A problem for humanity, though, is lately people seem to want to tug open only that bottom drawer, data, as if it were the only place you can find any answers, as if only data tells because only data sells. In How Data Happened, A History from the Age of Reason to the Age of Algorithms, published by Norton, the Columbia professors Chris Wiggins and Matthew L. Jones opened two of these four drawers, numbers and data. Wiggins is an applied mathematician who is also the chief data scientist at the Times. Jones is a historian of science and technology, and the book, which is pretty fascinating, if also pretty mathy, is an adaptation of a course they began teaching in 2017, A History of Data Science. It begins in the late 18th century with the entry of the word statistics into the English language. The book's initial chapters, drawing on earlier work like Theodore Porter's Trust in Numbers and Sarah Ego's The Averaged American and Khalil Gibran Muhammad's The Condemnation of Blackness, cover the well-told story of the rise of numbers as an instrument of state power and the place of quantitative reasoning both in the social sciences and in the state-sponsored study of intelligence, racial difference, criminology, and eugenics. Numbers, a century ago, wielded the kind of influence that data wields today. Of course, numbers are data too, but in modern parlance, when people say data, they generally mean numbers you need a machine to count and to study. Progressive-era social scientists employed statistics to investigate social problems, especially poverty, as they debated what was causation and what was correlation. In the 1890s, the Prudential Insurance Company hired a German immigrant named Frederick Hoffman to defend the company against the charge that it had engaged in discrimination by refusing to provide insurance to black Americans. His Race, Traits, and Tendencies of the American Negro, published in 1896 by the American Economic Association, delivered that defense by arguing that the statistical analysis of mortality rates and standards of living demonstrated the inherent inferiority of black people and the superiority of the Aryan race. In vain did W.E.B. Du Bois point out that suffering more and dying earlier than everyone else are consequences of discrimination, not a justification for it. Long before the invention of the general-purpose computer, bureaucrats and researchers had begun gathering and cross-tabulating sets of numbers about populations, heights, weights, ages, sexes, races, political parties, incomes, using punch cards and tabulating machines. By the 1930s, converting facts into data to be read by machines married the centuries-long quest for universal knowledge to 20th-century technological utopianism. The Encyclopedia Britannica, first printed in Edinburgh in 1768, a product of the Scottish Enlightenment, had been taken over for much of the 1920s by Sears Roebuck as a product of American mass consumerism. When in doubt, look it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, one 20th century newspaper ad read. The sum of human knowledge, 29 volumes, 28,150 pages, 44 million words of text, printed on thin but strong, opaque India paper, each volume but 1 inch in thickness, the book to ask questions of. When in doubt, look it up. But a 29-volume encyclopedia was too much trouble for the engineer who invented the cerebral library, so instead he turned 750,000 books into networked data. All the information in that entire library is mine, he cackled. All I have to do is operate this machine. I do not have to read a single book. His boast brings to mind Sam Bankman-Fried, the alleged crypto con man, who, in an interview last year, memorably said, I would never read a book. And why bother? By the 1930s, the fantasy of technological supremacy had found its fullest expression in the technocracy movement, which, during the Depression, vied with socialism and fascism as an alternative to capitalism and liberal democracy. Technocracy, briefly stated, is the application of science to the social order, a pamphlet called Technocracy in Plain Terms, explained in 1939. Technocrats propose the abolition of all existing economic and political arrangements, governments and banks, for instance, and their replacement by engineers, who would rule by numbers. Money cannot be used, and its function of purchasing must be replaced by a scientific unit of measurement, the pamphlet elaborated, assuring doubters that nearly everyone would probably come to like living under a technate. Under the technate, humans would no longer need names, they would have numbers. One technocrat called himself 1X1809X56. They dressed in gray suits and drove gray cars. If this sounds familiar, tech bros and their gray hoodies and silver Teslas, cryptocurrency and the abolition of currency, it should. As a political movement, technocracy fell out of favor in the 1940s, but its logic stuck around. Elon Musk's grandfather was a leader of the technocracy movement in Canada. He was arrested for being a member, and then, soon after South Africa announced its new policy of apartheid, he moved to Pretoria, where Elon Musk was born in 1971. One of Musk's children is named XAEA12. Welcome to the technate. The move from a culture of numbers to a culture of data began during the Second World War, when statistics became more mathematical, largely for the sake of becoming more predictive, which was necessary for wartime applications involving everything from calculating missile trajectories to cracking codes. Wiggins and Jones write, this was not data in search of latent truths about humanity or nature. This was not data from small experiments recorded in small notebooks. This was data motivated by a pressing need to supply answers in short order that could spur action and save lives. That work continued during the Cold War as an instrument of the national security state. Mathematical modeling, increased data storage capacity, and computer simulation all contributed to the pattern detection and prediction in classified intelligence work, military research, social science, and increasingly commerce. Despite the benefit that these tools provided, especially to researchers in the physical and natural sciences, in the study of stars, say, or molecules, scholars in other fields lamented the distorting effect on their disciplines. In 1954, Claude Levi Strauss argued that social scientists need to break away from the hopelessness of the great numbers, the raft to which the social sciences, lost in an ocean of figures, have been helplessly clinging. By then, national funding agency had shifted their priorities. The Ford Foundation announced that, although it was interested in the human mind, it was no longer keen on non-predictive research in fields like philosophy and political theory, deriding such disciplines as, quote, polemical, speculative, and pre-scientific, end quote. The best research would be, like physics, based on, quote, experiment, the accumulation of data, the framing of general theories, attempts to verify the theories, and prediction, end quote. Economics and political science became predictive sciences. Other ways of knowing in those fields atrophied. The digitization of human knowledge proceeded apace, with libraries turning books first into microfiche and microfilm, and then through optical character recognition, whose origins date to the 1930s, into bits and bytes. The field of artificial intelligence, founded in the 1950s, at first attempted to sift through evidence in order to identify the rules by which humans reason. This approach hit a wall, in a moment known as the knowledge acquisition bottleneck. The breakthrough came with advances in processing power and the idea of using the vast stores of data that had for decades been compounding in the worlds of both government and industry to teach machines to teach themselves by detecting patterns. Machines learning. Spies pioneered large-scale data storage, Wiggins and Jones write, but starting with the data from airline reservation systems in the 1960s, industry began accumulating data about customers at a rapidly accelerating rate, collecting everything from credit card transactions and car rentals to library checkout records. In 1962, John Tukey, a mathematician at Bell Labs, called for a new approach that he termed data analysis, the ancestor of today's data science. It has its origins in intelligence work and the drive to anticipate the Soviets. What would they do next? That Netflix can predict what you want to watch, that Google knows which sites to serve you, these miracles are the result of tools developed by spies during the Cold War. Commerce in the 21st century is espionage for profit. While all this was going on, the accumulation of data, the emergence of machine learning, and the use of computers not only to calculate but also to communicate, the best thinkers of the age wondered what it might mean for humanity down the line. In 1965, the brilliant and far-seeing engineer J.C.R. Licklider, a chief pioneer of the early Internet, wrote Libraries of the Future, in which he considered the many disadvantages of books. Quote, if human interaction with the body of knowledge is conceived of as a dynamic process involving repeated examinations and intercomparisons of very many small and scattered parts, then any concept of a library that begins with books on shelves is sure to encounter trouble, Licklider wrote. Surveying a million books on 10,000 shelves, he explained, is a nightmare. When information is stored in books, there is no practical way to transfer the information from the store to the user without physically moving the book or the reader or both, end quote. But convert books into data that can be read by a computer, and you can move data from storage to the user and to any number of users much more easily. Taking the contents of all the books held in the Library of Congress as a proxy for the sum total of human knowledge, he considered several estimates of its size and figured that it was doubling every couple of decades. On the basis of these numbers, the sum total of human knowledge as data would, in the year 2020, be about a dozen petabytes. A zettabyte is a petabyte with six more zeros after it. So Licklider, who really was a genius, was off by a factor of 100,000. Consider even the billions of documents that the U.S. government deems classified, a number that increases by 50 million every year. Good faith research suggests that as many as 9 out of 10 of these documents really shouldn't be classified. Unfortunately, no one is making much headway in declassifying them. Thousands of documents relating to JFK's assassination in 1963, for instance, remain classified. That is a problem for the proper working of a government and for the writing of history, and not the least for former presidents and vice presidents. In The Declassification Engine, What History Reveals About America's Top Secrets, published by Pantheon, the historian Matthew Connolly uses tools first developed for intelligence and counterintelligence purposes, traffic analysis, anomaly detection, and the like, to build what he calls a declassification engine, a technology that could help identify truly sensitive information, speed up the declassification of everything else, and, along the way, produce important historical insights. Connolly, like Wiggins and Jones, is affiliated with Columbia's Data Science Institute. The problem is urgent, and the project is promising. The results can be underwhelming. After scanning millions of declassified documents from the State Department's Foreign Relations of the United States series, for instance, Connolly and his team identified the words most likely to appear before or after redacted text, and found that Henry Kissinger's name appears more than twice as often as anyone else's. Kissinger, who was famously secretive, was the Secretary of State from 1973 to 1977. This is a little like building a mapping tool, setting it loose on Google Earth, and concluding that there are more driveways in the suburbs than there are in the city. By the beginning of the 21st century, commercial, governmental, and academic analysis of data had come to be defined as data science. From being just one tool with which to produce knowledge, it has become, in many quarters, the only tool. On college campuses across the country, data science courses and institutes and entire data science schools are popping up like dandelions in spring, and data scientist is one of the fastest growing employment categories in the United States. The emergence of a new discipline is thrilling, and it would be even more thrilling if people were still opening all four drawers of that four-drawer filing cabinet instead of renouncing all other ways of knowing. Wiggins and Jones are careful to note this hazard. They write, "At its most hubristic, data science is presented as a master discipline, capable of reorienting the sciences, the commercial world, and governance itself." It's easy to think of the ills produced by the hubristic enthusiasm for numbers a century ago, from the IQ to the GDP. It's easy, too, to think of the ills produced by the hubristic enthusiasm for data today and for artificial intelligence, including in a part of the Bay Area now known as Cerebral Valley. The worst of those ills most often have to do with making predictions about human behavior and apportioning resources accordingly. Using algorithms to set bail or sentences for people accused of convicted of crimes, for instance. Connolly proposes that the computational examination of declassified documents could serve as, quote, the functional equivalent of CT scans and magnetic resonance imaging to examine the body politic. He continues to argue that history as a data science has to prove itself in the most rigorous way possible by making predictions about what newly available sources will reveal, end quote. But history is not a predictive science. And if it were, it wouldn't be history. Legal scholars are making this same move. In The Equality Machine, Harnessing Digital Technology for a Brighter, More Inclusive Future, published in Public Affairs, Orly Lobel, a University of San Diego law professor, argues that the solution to biases in algorithms is to write better algorithms. Fair enough, except that the result is still ruled by algorithms. What if we stopped clinging to the raft of data, returned to the ocean of mystery, and went fishing for facts? In 1997, when Sergey Brin was a graduate student at Stanford, he wrote a listserv message about the possible malign consequences of detecting patterns in data and using them to make predictions about human behavior. He had a vague notion that discrimination was among the most likely results of data mining. He considered the insurance industry. Quote, auto insurance companies analyze accident data and set insurance rates of individuals according to age, gender, vehicle type, he pointed out. And if they were allowed to by law, they would also use race, religion, handicap, and any other attributes they find are related to accident rate. Insurers have been minimizing risk since before the Code of Hammurabi, nearly 4,000 years ago. It's an awfully interesting story, but for Brin, this was clearly a fleeting thought, not the beginning of an investigation into history, language, philosophy, and ethics. All he knew was that he didn't want to make the world worse. Don't be evil became Google's model. But if you put people's brains in glass jars and burn all your books, bad things do tend to happen. Next, I'll read a poem from the April 10th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Morning Song by Jim Moore. It's a lucky day for me if they are burning on the hill, the cut and fallen branches. Fire consumes wood, smoke consumes air. Lucky day to see what burns and smokes inside me. If I sit at the window long enough, I know the moon will come back. Is that enough then? I don't mean is the moon enough, but is the waiting for the moon enough? I'm asking, is the blue enough in Mary's robe as she cradles her dead son in her lap? It is Bellini's blue in the academia. I stood for so long in front of it that the guard, sitting on his little stool, stopped whistling Bridge Over Troubled Water and stared at me in silence. But I stayed right where I was. I had fallen in love with her. That feeling of being nowhere and everywhere at once, the way they say the gods felt when there were still gods. Meanwhile, it's 6 a.m., and there is smoky light on the mountain, the hill, the olive trees, those two birds hiding under the neighbor's red tiles. Serve us, they sing, us and us alone. Are they swallows or swifts? After all these years, I still don't know. And now a poem from the April 3rd, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Reincarnation by Marie Howe. Sometimes when I look at our dog, Jack, I think he might be my radical American history professor come back to make amends. He gazes at me so sorrowfully. What is it, Jack? I say, why do you look like that? But Jack doesn't answer. He lies down and rests his head on his paws. Black hair covered nearly all of that man's body, thick under his blue Oxford shirt when I put my hand there. Perhaps that accounted for the bow tie, the pipe, the tweed cap. This time I can teach him to sit and to stay. Stay, I say to Jack, who looks at the treat in my hand, and then at me, and at the treat, and then at me, and he stays. Come, I say to Jack, but Jack does not always come. Sometimes he sits and looks at me a long time, as when my professor would lean back in his chair, draw on his pipe, and gaze at me. But when I hold a treat, Jack comes. And I remember how the professor would lick dripping honey from the jar, lick peanut butter from the knife. A little stubborn, our dog Jack. Shy, we thought. Until the morning my daughter jumped on my bed and Jack sprang at her growling. And the next morning when he rushed toward her growling and bit her skirt and tore it and bit her and broke her skin. And then I went to collar him. Bit me, snarling, and bit and bit. That's when I was pretty sure he was my history professor. The vet said this happens more often than you'd imagine. He must always be tethered, she said, until he can be trusted. He must learn that you and your daughter come first. And no more couch, no more sleeping in bed with you, Mama. Not ever. I finally left him so late at night it was nearly dawn, picking up my boots by the door, stepping down the two flights, then running toward the car. What can I say? Jack may be my American history professor come back after all these years to make amends. Or Jack may be actually himself a dog. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.